Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ashley Madison, the dating website for cheaters, sold itself as discreet and secure. Last month, the world learned that the Canadian-based company had oversold itself on that score when its site was hacked and hundreds of gigabytes of company and user data stolen. The hackers have since made good on threats to release the data if the site wasn't closed. Joining us by phone is senior writer for Wired, Kim Zetter. Welcome back to the show, Kim.
Thank you.
So how did the hackers gain access to the names and accounts of Ashley Madison users? Where did their security system fail?
Well, we still don't know that yet. We've had just a few hints. We know that they didn't get in through the basic way that a lot of hackers get into websites, which is called a SQL injection attack. They didn't use that. Ashley Madison forensic investigators are telling us that they didn't use a software vulnerability. So that implies some other method of getting in. It may have been a phishing attack that got credentials for administrator, and which would have given them access to databases. But it's really unclear at this point.
So what all has been released?
So we had a huge data dump last week that contained about 36 million email addresses that were used to open accounts. We got some credit card transactions, and that's probably the most damning part. That included real names of and addresses and phone numbers of people who charged fees or who paid fees on the Ashley Madison website. And why I say that that's more damning, because you can open an account at Ashley Madison under any name for free and just sort of browse the activities on there. But in order to actually engage in chats with other members and try to make hookups, you had to pay a fee. And so anyone using their real credit card, their real details would have been in that database.
There's been some tragic repercussions from this.
Yeah, so far, we've had news reports. I think they're a little unconfirmed, though, of two suicides that may have been related to this. There was a police chief in Texas who committed suicide, and he had an account at Ashley Madison. I don't know that anyone's definitively made the connection between the discovery of his account and his death, but I think that that is one of the unfortunate and tragic fallouts of what happens when hackers release this kind of data.
Of course, I'm a super dork. I'd never even heard of Ashley Madison before this, but there were millions of people who did.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a caveat with that. You know, Ashley Madison, of course, touts that it had 40 million customers. Many of those probably would have been multiple accounts by single customers, so we don't know if that number is accurate. We also know that the site probably had a lot of false accounts created on it. We know that there was at least a lawsuit by a former employee who claimed that Ashley Madison had hired her to create false female accounts in order to lure more male customers. So we don't really know if that figure is how much it's inflated. I'm with you. I didn't have much knowledge of it until the hack, but I think a lot of people did because there were Super Bowl ads, at least in the U.S.
Can anyone access this list of names or emails?
Anyone can access it now. It takes a little tech savvy to do it. The hackers had hosted it on what's called the dark web, which was a URL that's not accessible via a normal browser. You had to download a special Tor browser, and you had to know the exact URL in order to reach the site. And then even once you downloaded it, you had to have the ability to sort of decompress the files and put them in a readable format. Given that, however, there are a lot of people now that have done that and are making the data available in an easier format. There's a hacker site called Pastebin where someone is just basically posting the plain text data in numerous posts that anyone can access.
What do we know about the motivation of the hackers?
Well, we only know what they've said so far, and we don't know how much we can trust that. But they took issue with what they considered the immorality of what Ashley Madison was promoting, infidelity and adultery on the website. They also took issue with Ashley Madison's business practices. They claimed that Ashley Madison offered a service for $20, $19 if you paid it, they would delete all of your activity from the site. And the hackers claimed that while they would delete the outward-facing activity of your site, such as your profile, the data remained on the servers for someone to find. And, of course, when the hackers hacked Ashley Madison, they did find data that was left over from people who had asked for their information to be deleted.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Ashley Madison issue with my guest, Kim Zetter. She's senior staff writer at Wired. Ashley Madison is the Canadian-based company that created a website, a dating website for people who want to cheat or have relationships. I don't know. Is it just for cheaters? Can you describe, Kim Zetter, better what Ashley Madison did?
Yeah, I mean, it was promoting infidelity. And okay. So, you know, their motto was life is short, so having an affair. So there were people, what I'm hearing from people who had accounts on the site, not all of them were married. Some of them were single, just looking for hookups with married people that wouldn't have an attachment. There were a lot of people who were, you know, sort of in between relationships. But I think for the most part, it was designed for married people who wanted to have illicit affairs.
What is Ashley Madison doing now to make their site more secure?
Well, when I spoke with someone who's working on their forensic team, he did say that they are now examining all of their software code to look for vulnerabilities so that other hackers wouldn't be able to use it to get in. And that's important because the hackers didn't just unleash customer data. They actually unleashed the source code for Ashley Madison's website. And when you unleash the source code, that gives other hackers the ability to look through the code and find vulnerabilities that they can use to hack the site. So they're frantically now trying to go through their code to make sure that there aren't other vulnerabilities that other hackers could use. They are looking at shoring up their networks. That would mean segregating sensitive data from outward-facing systems, and there are probably a host of other things that they're doing. It's a little late at this point.
Yeah. Are they now? Is it offline now?
No, the site is still up. They are still running as if normal, as if nothing has happened.
Any sense about how business has been affected for them?
I don't know. Everyone keeps asking me, can Ashley Madison recover from this? I don't know. I would have thought yes after the initial the customer data leak, because we've seen a lot of companies that have suffered customer data leaks and they still thrive. But with the unleashing of the source code, that creates a lot more problems for Ashley Madison, because Ashley Madison was looking to go public. They were looking to do an IPO this fall, and that makes it very difficult going forward for them to do any kind of public offering at this point.
And you said you talked to their forensic people. Do they have any way of identifying who the hackers were at this point?
Well, I think that, you know, the CEO made a very bold claim in an initial interview right after the hack went public, and I think it was an ill-advised statement. He said that they were on to the perpetrator and that they were certain that it was someone who at one time had access to their networks, although he implied that it wasn't an employee. So that meant maybe it was a one-time contractor or something like that. But he put that statement out there, and it seems to me that, I don't really think that they have much evidence in that regard. We do have some sign that the hackers, when they posted the data last week, made a mistake in the not sort of locking down the server that they were using to distribute the data. And when that was made apparent to them, they immediately stopped loading data, and then they're using another technique. So it's hard to engage in this kind of activity and not make mistakes. So it's possible they have left some footprints.
There's now a large cash reward for information leading to the arrest of the hackers. How often are hackers, realistically, how often are they caught?
Well, much more often than they used to be. It used to be that if you were outside the U.S., it was a good chance that you were never going to get caught. But the U.S. has worked very diligently over the last decade to have relationships with other countries. And so there's a lot of cooperation and a lot more ability to actually reach out and grab hackers who are overseas. And also, you know, we have the NSA now, who is using its own sort of signals intelligence to aid investigations. And so, they have a bigger watch on what's going on internationally on networks. So I think that it's also, I want to point out that often what gets people caught is not just the forensic data, but they end up telling someone or an accomplice
gets caught.
The usual
reasons.
Yes, yeah. An accomplice gets caught and then becomes a turncoat. Hmm. So that's one of the ways that we'll see arrests happen.
How are there very many other websites like Ashley Madison out there? And if so, how are they handling themselves?
Yes, there are. And, you know, and Ashley Madison isn't the first one to get hacked. I think that, you know, this is a lesson for all of them. Ashley Madison, you know, really touted itself, though, as being secure and protecting the privacy of its customers. And anytime you sort of make those claims, you put a target on your back for hackers to prove you wrong. So I think that a lot of companies, they've put up these sites without really thinking of security. And this is going to force them now to take that much more seriously. Also, you know, I want to point out that the FTC came out. There was a court case this week that's significant in this matter, where the ruling was that the FTC has authority to go after companies that haven't secured their networks and haven't secured customer data. So we may eventually see some kind of repercussions for this, for not securing data better.
Meaning, if they make the claim, they got to back it up.
Yes, it would be sort of false advertising, exactly.
But, I mean, what would we compare that to? I mean, you know, even the best bank vault in the world, they say, can be broken into by the right person.
Yes, so this is a difficulty because we don't have a standard for security. You can't say, okay, if you do this and this and this, then you're going to be secure and no one's ever going to get into you. Security isn't a static thing. You can have a secure network one day, and then the next day you add another server or you add some new software, you reconfigure it, and you've created new vulnerabilities. So it's really difficult to know what the measurement is going to be, the threshold for when you decide that someone did due diligence for security and when they didn't.
I know that journalists all over the world are tapping into Ashley Madison, trying to figure out if anybody they know or anyone they cover has participated in Ashley Madison. But you and I spoke off air briefly before we went on, and you said that is if they did it on purpose. Somebody you said it's likely that a lot of email addresses, which are how people are identified, were stolen or borrowed.
Right. So you're going to get a lot of false positives. Even the websites that have popped up where you can, you know, insert an email address and figure out if they had an account, that doesn't tell you that the account was actually used or that the email address belonged to the person who owns the email address. It can be that people just sort of borrowed email addresses, borrowed profile pictures, things like that of others. And so I think that's a cautionary tale that people should not assume that just because an email address was used at Ashley Madison that the person behind that email address was the one who had an account there.
It would be the issue of the fees being paid and having that data available.
Right. However, someone can use a stolen credit card, again, to pay the fees. And so there's some caution there that you have to take as well.
And if somebody has had their data exposed, is there any way to ever get that erased now?
No, it's out there. And millions of people have access to it now. That's the thing with these breaches. You can't take them back. Once the data is out there, it's out there.
Okay. Well, Kim Zetter, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Kim Zetter, she's a senior staff writer at Wired. More Tech Tuesday coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Sentient computers that comprehend language and can make decisions based on conversations with us. It's the stuff of science fiction, right? Now tech giants such as Google and Facebook are ready to take a step in that direction. The field of AI, referred to as deep learning, is on the forefront. And deep learning developers are coming up with remarkable results that are silencing the skeptics. Joining us now by phone is San Francisco Bureau Chief for MIT Technology Review, Tom Simonite. Welcome back.
Good morning, Anne. Nice to be here again.
Where did the idea of mimicking brain function as a means of AI originate?
It originates way back at the start of the field of AI in the 1950s. And when you think about it, if you want to build something smart, if you look around, what's the best example we have? It's the human brain. And so right at the very beginning, some of the early scientists, particularly in the U.S., thought, well, if we want to make machines that can do the stuff we can do, why not take some hints from the brain? Now, in the 50s, people were just starting to figure out some of the very basic features of how the neurons in our brain communicate. And so they created what you might call a kind of napkin sketches of what they knew about the brain, and made software based on that, and got started from there. And very quickly they were able to come up with machines and software that could do things like learn to tell the difference between a circle and a square, which on the one hand is pretty basic, but on the other, is particularly at the time, was very remarkable that something artificial could do this.
In your article, you talk about deep learning. What does it mean? How does it distinguish from this more traditional idea of AI?
Right. Well, so in the 50s, some people did start with the brain-inspired approach, but then it got put aside for several decades because results really weren't that great. And so the big results in AI that we've probably heard about, you know, like chess-playing computers being better than humans, those really came from more kind of traditionally mathematical and logic-based approaches. They weren't based on the brain. But some people never gave up on this idea, and they worked on it for decades and decades. And really, when they were proven right and their ideas took hold was just in the last 5 years or so. And that's when this field of deep learning really came to the fore. And the proof came really in about 2012 when deep learning won this competition that researchers hold for software that tries to recognize images. It's called ImageNet. And this had been held for a long time, and the software was okay at it, but not great. The way the task works is your software gets to look at about 100,000 images as a practice kind of learning session. And then after that, it has to sit the final exam, as it were, and identify all the different pictures, which have got, you know, about 1,000 different categories of things. So, you know, there's dogs, there's cats, houses, mosquitoes, things like this. And in 2012, a group of researchers from the University of Toronto, with this deep learning approach, which was kind of unfashionable, you know, a lot of people didn't think it was really that useful. They just totally blew away the competition. And since then, a lot of researchers in universities and all the major tech companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, IBM, have switched to deep learning because it just proves to be extremely good at some things that have previously been very hard for software. And so we've seen huge improvements in software that can recognize images. I think the latest results from Google and Microsoft and the other companies, their deep learning software can do just about as good as a human can on this standard ImageNet test. And we've also seen big improvements in speech recognition. And so I think in 2012, Google was able to reduce the error rate of its speech recognition software on phones by about 25%, which is a big jump. And you may have noticed that when you talk to your phone, whether it's Siri or you talk to Google Search, it's a lot better than it used to be.
There's no comparison. I'll just say that from my experience. I can't believe how much has changed. And it's because of this deep learning process.
That's right. Yeah. And so what's really different about deep learning is deep learning software can really figure things out for itself. It doesn't need as much of a helping hand as previous learning software did.
Why is that? What exactly is it doing?
Well, a good way to illustrate that is to think about facial recognition. You know, so facial recognition has been around for a very long time, particularly in law enforcement. But it used to be that if you wanted to train a piece of software to tell different faces apart, you would need to tell it the basics first. Like, you would need to explicitly write code to tell it how to spot, like, an edge or a corner or an eye or something like that. Mm-hmm. And deep learning software doesn't actually, and that takes a really long time, and people earn PhDs and spend their whole careers trying to figure out better ways to put that knowledge into the software. Mm-hmm. With deep learning, you really don't need to do that. If you make the right piece of software, which kind of takes the form of a network of kind of fake neurons, you might think of them, very, very crude mimics of the neurons that we know from biology. If you build that the right way, you can tell it to start learning and it will just figure it out from scratch. It doesn't need explicitly telling how to spot different parts of an image, how to spot different colors, different shapes, how to spot an eye. It will just work that out for itself.
How far has the research come? How far could it go?
It's come a long way. So the first big results came in image recognition and in speech recognition, mm-hmm. and that is now very much out into the world. As I said, anytime you talk to your phone, your speech is being processed by deep learning. The image recognition stuff is also getting out there. Google has this photo organization service called Google Photos, which uses deep learning to solve that problem of just having too many photos and not being able to find the one you want. So instead of having to put everything in folders and organize them, you can just search for a term like, say, beach or bridge or forest. And because it can look at the content of your images and understand what's in them, it will find them for you. And that's pretty useful. The next frontier is really language. So language is how we communicate and explain and understand the world around us. And a lot of the leading researchers and companies working on deep learning, they think that is where the next breakthrough in AI is going to come.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the deep learning category of artificial intelligence. My guest is Tom Simonite. He's MIT Technology Review's San Francisco Bureau Chief. If you have a question, if you have a comment, you can give us a call. Join the conversation, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. Post your question or comment there, or check us out on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. So how will companies such as Facebook and Google take advantage of this research? I mean, we've already talked about, you know, our phones responding to our voices so much better now. How might Facebook wade into this and make a buck off of it? Because that's what they do, is make money.
Right. So Facebook has already rolled out some of the image recognition deep learning system. And so that is now a part of how they recognize faces in images. But as I said, Facebook and others are now pushing into using deep learning to help software understand language, so understand what we mean. And that could be very lucrative and also useful. So if you think about the way that Google and Facebook make money, it's serving advertisements. And the way they decide which advertisements to show you is by looking at, you know, the words you typed into that search box, or looking at what your friends wrote on their Facebook update. And so improving the ability of software to understand what you really meant, that could have very clear effects on the type of adverts they show you and the things they can do. But I think more interesting is really how software that understands language better than it does today could really change our relationship with machines and be very helpful. I think most of us have probably experimented with Siri, Apple's virtual personal assistant or similar systems, and they can be pretty useful already today. It's useful to be able to pull out your phone and say, you know, "Hey Siri, set a reminder" or something like that. But they don't really understand what we say. You know, you have to sort of pick from a menu, as it were. There are only certain things you can ask. And the work that's taking place now, particularly at Facebook's group, where they're very keen on this, could allow virtual personal assistants to be much more broad in what they can help with and to be much more capable of understanding different ways of phrasing the same thing. When I spoke with Facebook's chief technology officer, he understands that his research lab is still working on this, but he's already thinking about how he might use it on Facebook. And so one thing he talked about a lot was information overload. So there is just so much information coming at us every day. Mm-hmm. And Facebook already tries to filter it. But if they really know what you're interested in or what your friends are saying or what's happening in the world, then they can filter it much better. And so he gave the example of, he was saying, you know, we often have a problem where, you know, there are certain friends who we we want to keep in touch with, but we don't necessarily want to know everything about their life. And he was saying, look, I want you to be able to say, hey, Facebook, show me Dave's baby photos, but don't show me any of Dave's jokes.
Really?
And yeah, and again, you know, between you know, two humans, that's a pretty easy sentence to understand. But mm-hmm. I mean, there's just no way you could do that on Facebook or you know, with the software we have today. You know, what is a joke? How do you recognize a joke? It's very hard to explain mm-hmm. Or program it. And so, with deep learning, the idea is machines could learn this kind of language ability for themselves.
One of the plot lines in science fiction is always, yeah, there's the deep learning. You're teaching something to a machine, and it's learning on its own. But the fear is, or the plot thickens when the machine decides to continue learning when you haven't directed it to.
Yeah, that's right. And there have been some high profile figures who've voiced that concern in the last couple of years. I think partly inspired by the big results we've seen from deep learning. So Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla, has talked about it. Also Stephen Hawking, the British physicist. When you talk to the researchers who are really on the cutting edge of AI, they're quite they are respectful of other people's opinion, but they're quite dismissive of the idea that we need to be scared right now mm-hmm. about the machines rising up. Although the results have been astounding from deep learning, and being able to search your photos and talk to your computer much better is great, we're still at a very basic level of intelligence. And certainly these systems are not showing any sign of being able to take initiative or have any type of self-awareness. You know, they still struggle outside of the very specific scenarios they're designed for.
But the idea is that someday they'll be able to tell the difference between a picture on a beach and a joke.
Yeah, and I think that could be very possible in the near term. But how do you get from that to something? That's just so far from something which is conscious and has ideas of its own. Now, I do think there are some nearer term issues we need to think about, and that's to do with what software like this will do to the workforce and to our daily lives when we're surrounded by these systems which are able to understand things and make decisions and filter the information we see. So, the idea that machines can take over quite manual labor that you might find in a car plant, picking up parts and putting them on a conveyor belt. We've got used to that, but it was quite a big disruption. And as software gets better at working with language and understanding things that right now we really need people to do, that's going to have an impact on the labor market.
Are you talking about people like reference librarians who have already been hit hard by the whole Google world, or what are you talking about?
Well, I guess potentially it could be a lot of people who – I think a lot of people will be – similar to Google search, right? I think a lot of kind of knowledge workers, it's affected their jobs, whether you're a lawyer or a journalist or anything else. It's not necessarily like about people being replaced, but it's more about the type of activity that humans do and machines do changing and shifting, and we need to be aware of that. Just to take an example, there are companies now which work on software which can write up financial reports, mm-hmm. even journalism or simple write-ups of baseball games, that kind of thing.
Right.
We're going to see more and more of this software doing things that, when you first hear about that, you think, wow, that's amazing. I didn't think software was able to be creative or, to do that kind of thing. And the capabilities of AI software is going to keep improving.
Well, of course, I've heard other people say, well, maybe it's not so much they're being creative as maybe it isn't that big of a deal if someone writes up a bit about a baseball game or a financial report.
Yeah, right. And actually, to take the example of a baseball game, maybe that's good because it frees your cover reporter to do something more broad. But you made a very good point there, Ant, which is that one thing about the history of AI is it's even, the field experts have been surprised by what is easy and what is hard for machines to do. And so it really wasn't that didn't take that long in the history of AI to figure out how to get machines to play chess better than humans. And that was a surprise to some people, because at the very beginning they thought, well, what is the most, what's, you know, the most impressive intellectual achievement of humans? And you might think, well, a chess grandmaster, you know, people recognize those people as being extremely intelligent, and you think, well, that would be hard for machines. But actually, it turned out it wasn't that difficult, and you didn't need to take this brain-inspired approach to solve chess, as it were. And now it's relatively easy to come up with a chess program that can beat anyone in the world. Other things have proved to be very difficult, and so images has proven to be very difficult, although we now seem to be going somewhere with that. Language and kind of common sense and understanding the world, that still looks really, really hard, but there are people who think it's coming within our grasp.
All right. Well, we'll continue to follow this along with you, Tom Simonite. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anne.
Tom Simonite, he's MIT Technology Review's San Francisco Bureau Chief. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. BlackBerry, once a giant in the smartphone field, has struggled for relevance with stiff competition from Apple and Android phones. Now, a new phone from BlackBerry looks to change that, using Android as its operating system. Joining us to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, BlackBerry is the ongoing saga of BlackBerry, now has turned to Android. Is it surprising to you that they've waited this long to go this route?
It's not. Honestly, this is BlackBerry has tried for a really long time to maintain, you know, this kind of constant vertical where they are the ones in charge of everything, the hardware, the software, the services. And it worked really well for them, not so much in the consumer space, but in the enterprise space. You know, this was something that they could go to businesses and say, you know, we own all of this, so we can guarantee its security. And you know, these are, you know exactly what you get when you have a BlackBerry device. And so that was something that a lot of larger businesses relied on for years. But, Apple and Google both have made really significant efforts over the last couple of years to kind of chip away at that enterprise space. And at the same time, BlackBerry really wasn't doing anything to approach the consumer space, smartphones are becoming, such a commodity thing that, you know, it was really kind of a mistake for them to not do that. Now I think they're trying to do both at the same time, where they're approaching the consumer space and trying to maintain the enterprise space at the same time with what looks like the BlackBerry Venice, which hasn't been officially announced yet, but we've seen so many pictures and talks about it that it certainly seems like this is going to be something we're going to see soon.
The BlackBerry Venice, what do you get with the name of that?
Well, so this is a continuation of a design we've seen from BlackBerry a couple times in the past, where it is this flat kind of candy bar looking phone with a screen covering the entire front of it. But when you push up on the screen, you actually get that classic BlackBerry keyboard sitting underneath of the screen, which is cool because, phones with keyboards have almost died. You know, we've tried so hard to replace them with just screens. And there is definitely a group of people out there who would still really appreciate having a keyboard.
Yeah, we talked about that last week.
Yeah, because, Samsung's trying to bring it back with this weird little accessory for the Galaxy line. And so, this could be a really big deal for people who want access to all of the Android apps that aren't available on BlackBerry, but still want that keyboard feel, because nobody does a smartphone keyboard like BlackBerry. There have been so many companies that have tried, and none of them have ever been as good as the BlackBerry keyboard.
So that's what BlackBerry brings to the table then?
Currently, yeah. I mean, and it's also, the BlackBerry services. There are people who still use BlackBerry's communication and email services that really rely on those to to do things. And you know, BlackBerry has tried to make those services, especially their chat service, the BlackBerry Messenger and BlackBerry Enterprise Server, you know, something that more people can use. But it's been kind of a slow crawl, and I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, not having that kind of dedicated experience on a consumer device. So we'll probably see more of that.
How much does this matter to Android?
I think this is a pretty big deal to Android because, you know, BlackBerry has a certain kind of golden standard when it comes to security, and that's something that Apple and Google have both tried really hard to compete with, but have never, you know, been able to make a lot of the same claims that BlackBerry makes as far as security and an operating system that is harder to kind of modify and adjust. You think about how many times with Android devices you see root access for people who want to kind of tinker around and do things, and with iPhones, the same thing called jailbreaking. But with BlackBerry devices, it's not as common. It still happens occasionally, but it's not as common. And even after you do so, there's not as much that you can do. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if BlackBerry is able to contribute something to, you know, the security of Android, or if this just ends up being another device in kind of the ocean of devices that are running the Android operating system.
Right. And you mentioned, as of right now, nothing's been officially released about the new BlackBerry. Any idea about how long it'll be, what it'll mean? I mean, what's it going to cost, that kind of thing?
So BlackBerry devices are typically run, you know, between $400 and $600. They haven't given any firm indication because there's not been an official announcement yet. But this is the kind of thing that we would see in September or October. You know, BlackBerry has a pretty... Now, I don't want to say rigid, but they're on a schedule a lot of times when it comes to device launches, and we're coming up on, you know, that kind of fall rush where we start to see a lot of things that are being announced just before Christmas.
Do you see this as something furthering their corporate market, which has sort of been their foothold, or at least was for a long time? Or is this something that they're doing that they see to really expand that individual consumer market?
Well, I think that's what's really interesting about this. I think it's both. And I think that this is something that BlackBerry has needed for a while, is, you know, that kind of single device that really does focus in both areas. They've got a lot in the way of maintaining that kind of, you know, enterprise push. But this is something that, you know, as a consumer, I would easily consider using just because it, you know, it looks so nice. And there are definitely times where having a keyboard on my phone is something that I want.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in this whole keyboard issue, and we talked about it last week, and we're talking about it again, and I just wonder what it is that's bringing that about. I mean, I know I actually have lost sensory nerve in a couple of my fingers from an accident, and but it's not my thumbs. I mean, so what difference does it make?
Right.
So
yeah, I mean one of those things that, you know, when it comes to my typing, I've gotten so used to using those tracing keyboards,
yeah,
where I just take my finger and run it along the keyboard, you know, but I know so many people who still use just their thumbs to, you know, type in things on the keys. So it would be interesting to see whether or not I could switch back and forth and actually be comfortable using it.
All right. Well, more on that, I'm sure, to come down the road. You also wanted to talk about Android smartwatches. They're getting a software update. What are some of the big changes?
Sure. So the next big change that we're going to see in Android Wear, which is actually rolling out right now, has a lot to do with watch faces that are interactive. And this is something that was kind of weird that neither Apple nor Google thought to do this when they first came out. We have these, you know, really pretty watch faces, and then when we get an email or something, like a card or a notification pops up and it does this, but it's not actually part of the watch face, which is weird because we have a lot of people who have, you know, inboxes where they want just that kind of inbox number to let them know how many messages they have or how many Facebook, you know, comments they have or something like that. And so that's what these new watch faces are all about. They give developers tools to build in kind of interactivity for the other services that your phone connects to. So if you want a watch face that is constantly giving you an update on how many steps you've taken throughout the day, but also gives you access to the emails that you want to look at a glance or something like that, that information is actually built into the watch face instead of being separate things that you have to scroll through. You can get all of that information just by looking at the watch.
And what about any new apps?
So, you know, with this is going to come just a big push towards, you know, having watch faces that also act like apps. And to do that, Google worked out with, I think, 15 different companies to make sure that there was a group of apps for people to check out as soon as it happened. And so now, you know, you can check. There's a bunch of really cool ones. My favorite right now is it's called the Poohy Watch Face. Where it just gives you, it's just really, really pretty and gives you access to a ton of information.
Like the emails, how many emails, what time is, that whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing for me is, you know, calendar.
Yeah.
You know, where I can look down and see when my next meeting is or something like that. The emails aren't quite as big a deal to me. And the step counter is one of those things that, just kind of annoys me, but a lot of people really love having that step counter thing. But yeah, so these are all kind of modular, where you can go through and put in the things that you want.
Okay.
And they all show up.
Now, speaking of smartwatches, let's get an update on how the Apple Watch has been doing. I've read not so great.
Well, so it's always really hard to judge the sales of a new Apple product 30 days in.
Yeah.
Because it's, a lot of what happens when Apple launches something in a new category is the social component, where, you know, the early adopters go out and buy things, but then they show all their friends. Mm-hmm. And what happens after that kind of 90-day period is that their friends go, man, this is something really cool that I have to have. And that hasn't happened yet. And there's a bunch of market data that you know, shows this happening, where you have the first 90 days where the early adopters go in and buy stuff. And then it's not until, 6 months after that where we see, like, a huge skyrocket in how these things sell. So it's hard for me to say whether it's been a success or a failure, because we haven't kind of hit that part in the market yet. But I will say that I know maybe one person who was really interested in having an Apple Watch when it first came out. And anyone else that I've talked to, as anecdotal as this is, had a lot to do with it just being really expensive compared to some of the other smartwatches.
They just
there.
Couldn't afford to jump in that way.
Well, and even it's not even so much, you know, not being able to afford is, you know, why is this thing $600 when my phone is $600?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
It's hard to justify the expense when it's not offering, that much compared to what it is that your phone is doing. And I think that, you know, Apple's trying really hard as far as marketing goes to push a lot of that. But an interesting comparison to the stuff that Android has been doing with Android Wear is that they, you know, developers can do things with apps, but developers can't touch any of the watch face stuff. That is entirely made and maintained by Apple.
Remind us again why Apple's like that.
Honestly, Apple has had this kind of walled garden approach to a lot of things for a long time. And
right.
it means that everything on a certain level is, you know, polished and exactly what you expect from an Apple product. There's no surprises. There's no, you know, well, it's somebody else's problem that this thing isn't working. And, you know, to Apple's credit, that's exactly what you get. You pick up this thing and the first couple of things that you look at are, you know, flawless. They work really well. They do that thing. But yeah, you can't add to that because it's Apple's experience entirely. And so that ends up being a problem once you get bored with those five or six things that you see that look really nice.
Okay. All right, Android 6.0 Marshmallow update on the way. It seems like Android just released a new version. What makes Marshmallow different than the last iteration of Android?
I sent this to you because the last time we did, we're so happy about the name of the dessert for the name of the operating system, and it was a really fun conversation, so I figured I would.
Well, I like Marshmallow a lot.
Yeah. So they you know, we've been using Google announced at their developer conference earlier this year that the next version of the operating system was going to focus really heavily on, you know, how things interoperate with one another, which is something that Android already does really well. You have apps that can talk to one another and share data across things, and that's going to end up being a big part of what happens next in Marshmallow. Is you're going to be able to go into an application, and when you go to search for something, it's searching for something, you know, not just within that application, but across the entire phone. And then it can pull data from one thing to another. So if you have photos that you've shared on Instagram and they've been tagged on Instagram and you're in an email, and you're looking for that photo to search, instead of tapping to open the gallery and flipping through the gallery to try and hunt down this picture, you can just search for whatever that tag was, and that information will then be pulled into the Mail app so that you can it's way fewer taps to locate that kind of stuff.
Can you give me an example? I do have a problem with that currently. So what you're saying is I can search for what's in the tag. Like what would that be?
Well, so if you've ever used Google Photos, you know that it's really, really good at pre-labeling a lot of the stuff that you take pictures of.
Mm-hmm.
It's this really silly game that a bunch of the people that I work with have, where you can just search for, you know, random things and get a list of things that Google's image detection system has found.
Oh, like beaches or, yeah, okay.
Exactly, yeah. Even like coffee cups and stuff like that. Like it's really good at picking those things out of photos and allowing you to search locally for those things. And so that's an example of, you know, that kind of pre-tag setup where you'd be able to find that and use, you know, basically through Google Now, where it searches across your entire account instead of specifically inside these individual apps and services.
Okay. It just broadens the scope. Okay. App permissions.
App permissions is something that Google admittedly has not ever done particularly well. You install an application and the application goes, hey, these are the parts of your phone that I have access to. You either install the app and, you know, take what I say, or, you know, you don't install the application if you don't want access to those things. And that's been a problem when we've had weird applications that ask for things like access to your entire phone book for
right.
seemingly no reason and stuff like that. And it's something that Apple has always done really well, giving users these kind of individual toggles to turn off when they don't want apps to have access to that kind of information. And mm-hmm. so in this next version of Android, that same system is going to be in place, where if you don't want an application, Facebook, for example, to have access to your location or your phone book or your contacts or your photos, you can tell it before it even runs not to ever have access to that information, and the Apple won't have access to it.
All right. Well, more importantly, can you go back and, redo the
– Oh, yeah.
Okay, the permissions on apps that already exist.
Yep, you can go in anytime and either disable or re-enable those same permissions.
Okay, and Android Pay will be introduced.
Android Pay is going to be introduced. This is just a rebranding of what we've seen already. It used to be called Google Wallet. It's a mobile payment system that existed, you know, it has existed for a couple of years now. It works very similarly to the way that Apple Pay works. I think Google was just, you know, changing the branding a little bit, and the interface that we get will be updated a little bit as well. But we haven't actually seen that yet, so not totally sure.
And when is Marshmallow going to be available for Android phones?
So if you are a developer, you can request access for it now and start messing with it now. We will see Marshmallow launch first on whatever the next phones that Google announced that have the Nexus branding. Which we will probably see within the next couple of weeks, up to, you know, a month or two away, usually no later than October for the launch of those devices. It's usually a phone or a tablet or both. And so that will come out first. And then the other phones that are in that lineup will get the update after.
Is this stuff that the developers are happy about, or is it more about the consumers?
A lot of this stuff are things that developers are really happy about. It makes, you know, cross communication between applications a lot easier, and that means that, you know, users are spending more time inside of those individual applications, which is really good for the developer, but it's also really good for the user.
And forgive me if I interrupted you when you were saying this, but can the update be downloaded from somewhere, or when, or where?
If you have an unlocked open device like one of the Nexus 6 or Nexus 5, then the update mm-hmm. can be downloaded right now, but it's a developer preview. So it's something that unless you're sure of what you're doing, you probably shouldn't mess with.
Okay.
But it is something that's open to, you know, Google's basically their developer devices or devices that are supported for developer use. And then, you know, more of that will become available once the you know, platform is officially available.
Okay. Well, Russell Holly, as always, thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly, contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Shia Linnott, and All Sides intern Ryan McFadden. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music, and video production is by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.